Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the information age an illusion, and is reason an inalienable human right or a privilege that belongs to a select few? Many of us rely on the internet to ensure instant access to knowledge across a wide spectrum of disciplines. But the ability to Google for a particular fact might be distracting us from the reality that many kinds of information, from nuclear physics to software to biotechnology, is currently off limits to most of us, even in this country where freedom of speech is among our most cherished rights. Even more alarming to my guest is the fact that in some cases, even thinking about particular concepts is essentially a violation of U.S. law. Robert B. Laughlin shared the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1998 for his work on the fraction quantum Hall effect. He is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Physics at Stanford University, and his new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Robert, welcome to Think.
Yes, hi.
You have said that instead of the age of information, we might very well be living in the age of amnesia. Will you talk about that?
Well, it's a big topic, obviously, and requires I had to write a book to articulate it clearly. But the basic idea is very, very simple. When you live in a deindustrialized time, as we do, where information is very valuable, it must be so that important information is dear. The reason is simply that no one will pay for information that's readily available. So as you shift over to the information economy, you necessarily have to give up the idea that knowledge is free.
And part of our sort of denial of all this stems from the fact that we make two separate categories, essentially. We look at technical information versus non-technical knowledge. But in your mind, there's really no difference.
Right. And this is something that matured in my mind over years. Of course, I'm a very techie person myself, but I'm also pretty articulate. My dad was a lawyer. And so I worry about intellectualism across the board. You'll find that very technical people are very sensitive to this because they understand it well, but they can't articulate it too well. Now, the idea, in short, is that technical knowledge isn't complicated because it's technical. It's complicated because it's valuable. In other words, human communication is always difficult, especially about important things. And the person talking to you has to work hard to be clear. But the moment a thing becomes valuable, that person stops working hard to be clear because it's just giving away the family jewels. And therefore, things that are important in our time tend to be abstruse. And this, of course, was always true, but it's gotten vastly worse as material things have commoditized. So yes, technical things aren't really inherently different. They're just hidden.
Yeah, and it's also gotten to the point whereas in the past, if one were to put forth the effort to learn particular things, they could have that knowledge. And now that knowledge is not even available to them because they can't access it.
Right, and that's the corollary of the whole thought process that really began to devastate me as an academic. Namely, the premise of public education or education generally is that you take responsibility onto yourself for bettering yourself through education. But we're entering a time now when that process is a crime. Namely, learning about certain things, the things that are important for making your living, is in many cases criminal. And therefore, the entire premise of bettering yourself through learning doesn't make any sense anymore. So a very bizarre consequence of the information age is that the education model that we've been working with in a free society has become obsolete.
Why, Robert, is it important to you to make a distinction between information and knowledge?
Well, it isn't really. I'm trying to communicate ideas to people, and you need words that rhetorically work. I guess the difference would be that knowledge is something I can use to better myself. Information is something that you can use to better yourself. In other words, advertising is advertising and spam are information. They contain some communication, but I can't use them to make money or to better my life. there basically to get me to turn me into a customer. Really valuable things, on the other hand, require a little work. They're not, the person won't give me those things for free. I have to ferret them out. And so I guess the distinction is economic.
One of the first kinds of knowledge that we decided to treat as special was understanding of nuclear technology. Can you talk about how we began to regulate that?
Right. Of course, as I explained in the book, I'm rather sensitive to that because I worked inside the fence at the Livermore Lab for many years in my career. And so I became aware of the things that other people aren't aware of. And also, I thought very deeply about how that happened and how they became secret and so forth. Now, nuclear knowledge or nuclear things generally are a little otherworldly. They're not in your face all the time in ordinary life, so it's easy psychologically to categorize them as different. Now, this isn't exactly true, of course, because cosmic rays are coming out of the sky all the time and changing your genes, but that's invisible. So what happened was, first of all, a psychological distinction between nuclear things and non-nuclear. And the second was the creation of the Atomic Energy Act, which declared certain kinds of pure knowledge to be born classified. That is to say, certain kinds of things you discover about the natural world are, by their very nature, a danger to society and therefore should not be known to everyone. The Atomic Energy Act is a very complex document, particularly since the criminal side of it is very, very difficult to enforce through ordinary legal means. So we live with a sequestration of this particular kind of knowledge as somewhat of a strange compromise between what we ethically think we should talk about and, on the other hand, what the law says. And it's just been permanently confused since 1954.
Robert B. Laughlin is my guest. He's a Nobel laureate in physics and professor at Stanford University. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Now, Robert, when you talk about information being being sort of classified at birth, this is not intellectual property, whereas someone has developed a technology that they can make money with and therefore they have a right to keep it secret. This is someone going out and discovering properties, physical properties of the universe, and that is automatically classified.
That's right. But the distinction here is not between laws of the universe and not laws of the universe. The distinction is between national security needs on the one hand and economic needs on the other. So governments have the task, at least our government does, of protecting you. And they do that by owning secret military technologies that they can invoke at the right time to defend you. And In military technology, always there's an element of secrecy, because if the enemy knows those things, then you don't have an advantage anymore. Now, the new thing that happened was the connection of military secrecy on the one hand with laws of nature on the other. That hadn't happened before the atomic age. Now, the other side of the coin is of course, protecting knowledge for economic reasons. Now, that's not defense, but the bottom line is kind of the same. You have a kind of economic warfare with your competitors, and you have to prevent them from knowing certain things, otherwise they can compete with you and drive you out of business. And so the competitive nature of the knowledge sequestration is the same in either case. But in one case, the sequestration is by the state, and in the other case, the sequestration is by an enterprise.
Let's go back to the national security issue for a minute, because a lot of people are really very comfortable with the idea that sort of experts and people who have been vetted in certain ways are the ones who get to be in charge of this research and these technologies. And I gather you went to press on the book before the suspect for the anthrax poisonings after 9/11 was identified. And, of course, he died before there was a trial. But the irony in this case is that the alleged perpetrator of those attacks that killed five people and made 17 people sick was one of essentially the government's identified good guys, someone who was supposed to be trusted with this information.
Well, yes. And so secrecy always has the problem that you can't impugn it. So someone tells you that you're safe because we're keeping the secrets, but, you know, a lot of times it isn't true. And then you have to weigh what you have to weigh the dangers. What's more dangerous, to have somebody with secret technology that spills out on occasion, or to make the thing openly public and easy to get for a terrorist who wants to use that same thing for military purposes? Now, to the best of my knowledge, no one knows the solution to this problem. And actually, one of the reasons I wrote this book is that I realized that the comfort that you feel is a political compromise that we are permanently stuck with. It isn't possible to let all of this knowledge out because it's just too dangerous. Ergo, you can't know everything that you might need to empower yourself. And now what we're doing at the moment is struggling over where that dividing line should be and what its nature should be. Now, anyway, you're right about the anthrax problem. I will say that what you know about military secrecy, which is this counts as that, is that a great deal of the public knowledge base about the technologies is untrue. And I personally suspect that some parts of the anthrax story are untrue, but of course it's never been to court, so we don't know what that is.
Can you talk for a minute about how the current climate of knowledge restriction really, for national security purposes, interferes with disciplines that have nothing to do with national security?
Well, sure, the knowledge exchange is like the economy. It works in mysterious ways because it's human activity. And when you keep something secret, it has unintended side effects. Now, unfortunately, it's often difficult to identify exactly what those are because the cause is secret. Moreover, the price you're paying is some development or some historical event that might have happened that didn't because the information wasn't there. Now, I guess the thing that's on my mind at the moment vis-a-vis that question is advances in biotech and software. We have very serious confrontations going on right now over how much biological knowledge should be out there and how much digital technology knowledge should be out there. And these struggles are very serious. So in the case of the digital stuff, that's, of course, very, very apparent to most people. The trade-offs there are clear. If you have very free, fast information exchange, you will tend to wipe out the intellectual content industries and so forth. Now, this is an hour seminar to answer the question that you just asked, and I'm sure you don't want an hour seminar, so I'll stop there.
Well, we'll stop for just a minute and take a break. Robert B. Laughlin is my guest. He's the 1998 Nobel laureate in physics and a professor at Stanford University. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we will talk about the consequences of gene patenting and many other things.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin. He's professor of physics at Stanford University. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Now, I realize, Robert, that there are parallel tracks of controlling information in the current climate. There is the national security question and that which is controlled by the government. And then, of course, there is the industrial and business interests. Is one a greater influence on the other, would you say?
No. They are different kinds of need. The defense side of the equation is governmental, and it is at the behest of the voters. Obviously, there's a political element as well, lobbying and so forth, but basically it represents us and the communal decision of us to make certain things disappear because they're too dangerous. Now, the other side of the equation is economic activity. And there, the problem is equally severe. But the interests are different. This week we're dealing with an economic meltdown, of course, the consequences of which we don't know. But what we do know is the economy works in mysterious ways having to do with trying to get things. It's kind of like a giant poker game, and this is shocking, especially to my kids this week, but that's just the way it is. Now, in a poker game, you cannot have free information. You make poker by making the other person think that you have things you don't. So free exchange of knowledge in a poker game is disastrous for the game. Ruin destroys it. Now, if you just hold that thought a minute and to imagine the information economy as a giant poker game, which it is, then free flow of any information you want is highly destructive to the workings of the economy. And that's the reality that we're facing right now. People like to talk about knowledge as something that belongs to the people, and now private companies are making it their own property, and how terrible that is. But what they haven't realized is that the ownership of knowledge is what the information economy means. If we have decided to move into an era where physical things are commodities and knowledge is the thing of value, then it must be that knowledge is property and the knowledge will become sequestered by people who have enormous amounts of money because knowledge and value are the same thing. In other words, it's a pact with the devil. You can't escape it. It's not evil industrialists taking your knowledge. It's that you're allowing knowledge to become property because you need to do that in order to live in the information.
Yeah, and you freely admit in the book, and this is so interesting, that opening all or most fields of knowledge up might come with a steep economic price. But like environmental stewardship, you say that we really need to consider how our actions today and our policies today are going to affect the climate later. Can you talk about the way the present climate of information control might, where it might lead us?
Sure. I've been watching these trends now for all of my professional life, and I think it's already had the key confrontation, which is the Millennium Copyright Act. And our society has decided as a whole that knowledge itself, transfer of understanding electronically, is not going to be free anymore because it's too destructive to an important part of the economy. And what I think is that decision, that de facto decision, will now ramify and take away a human right that we all thought we had, but in fact we don't, which is the right to understand things and tell other people about what we understood.
Yeah, it's nowhere in the Constitution that we have the right to reason or to learn.
No, and it wasn't necessary back in the 18th century because the technical means weren't enough to make it relevant. But what's happened is technology has caught up with you now so that this sort of obvious human right cogito ergo sum no longer makes any sense.
Is it reasonable to even talk about trying to put this down and express it in the Constitution?
You know, that's above my pay grade. Lots of people have asked me this, you know, wouldn't you like to indulge in punditry and tell the lawmakers what to do? In fact, I don't envy those people at all. I mean, not on top of this economic thing this week they're dealing with. The information sequestration is something that they've not wanted to do. But they've understood that to protect the film industry and the recording industry, they've had to do that. So they're already up to their ears in compromises that they don't like. And all I can say is God bless them, because I think myself there's no turning back, that we're going to have to give up this human right, and there is no solution.
Well, you can call it above your pay grade, but you do say in the book there are some comparisons to be drawn between the age of information and the age of slavery.
Right. Well, if you recall what happened in the age of slavery is that it never got resolved. We had to have a terrible civil war because it was the abrogation of this human right was necessary for the functioning of the economy, agricultural economy. And people did all sorts of mental gymnastics to justify why this abrogating this right was okay.
Including people who didn't believe slavery was right but thought they couldn't afford to change it.
Exactly. Okay. Now, so the lesson to draw there is not that the abolition of slavery was the obvious thing to happen, but rather that it was impossible to get rid of this horrible thing without a terrible war. Now, we look now in the present situation and ask what's likely to happen. Well, it's hard for me to look into the future, but I don't think, my best guess is that people won't go to war over this. My best guess is instead they'll give up the human right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Robert B. Laughlin. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Let's speak to Scott in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Oh, hello. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple of quick questions for Mr. Laughlin. Well, first, I guess to a person in specific, when you referred to the 50s and the sequestration of knowledge, do you think that Tesla would be a good example? Also, as an industry, do you think energy production is one of these that's the knowledge is falling down some sort of black hole? And finally, as a comment, as a student of history, I think it could be noted that change can only be held back so long, and that if it's withheld too long, change tends to happen by the law of unforeseen consequences, and sometimes violently, as you noted with the revolution. And I guess I'll just hang up and take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Hi, thanks a lot for the question. You bet. The answer is yes, yes, and yes. So Tesla, Nikola Tesla, is a beautiful example of a great mind who invented an important thing, namely AC power transmission. And when he did that, the thinking about how you should transmit power was in the public domain because it was unstable. Nobody knew the best way to do it. Now, of course, what happened is that electricity delivery, like delivery of fuel, is an industry that is very well developed and very excellent, by the way, and also very adept at protecting itself. So you say fallen down a black hole. Well, you know, it's fallen down a black hole. On the other hand, electricity is still dirt cheap. So it's, you know, not that black a hole. I mean, I have electricity here. It's just that the ownership of power transmission and generation technology is not mine. It's theirs. And that's the way it is right now. This, by the way, is a very serious comment, if you will, on public posturing about energy policy. See, underneath energy issues is this rather more fundamental thing that there's a property issue. And you can't talk in the abstract about energy and get anywhere. You have to understand first the ownership of the knowledge base and why that ownership is there, what the value propositions are, and so forth. So you're completely correct about that. Now, as for the comment, well, change is inevitable. You know, I'm a very boosterish thinker about the future generally, and so I tend to agree with you. On the other hand, I've been watching this problem essentially all my professional life since I decided to be a physicist, and the sign has been negative the entire time. And so on this particular matter, I'm not boosterish. I have actually a very black view of the future. I honestly think that this particular human right is going away, that it's inevitable, and that it's very unfortunate. You know, I probably wouldn't have chosen this particular line of work had I understood this back in the 60s, but I didn't. And so I think this is a very significant moment in history. Now, at this point, if we're going to have a further discussion about this, since it's so distressing, we need to break out a whiskey bottle and serious.
Well, it's only noon
anyway,
here, so.
I understand. Well, thanks a million for the question.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, there's this sort of pressure for information to come out. And you do write about spam, which is ultimately, as you found it, not the luncheon meat, but the sort of unsolicited advertising, is a democratic entity, despite its characteristics as information. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's not a democratic entity. It's advertising. So you see, if you make the means of communication cheap, then the economic issues then retreat back a step. The dear thing then is no longer the technology for communicating, it's what you're communicating. So naturally, the Internet gets used for advertising. Advertising is when I tell you something that isn't necessarily true and that induces you to buy my products. Or sometimes advertising is political untruths. The Internet turns out to be a fabulous agency of propaganda. Now, I'd rather not go down that particular road on this show, but, you know, that's another whiskey conversation. But at any rate, yes, it's filled up with advertising, so it's filled up with stuff that the sender wants, not things that the receiver wants. And that's just the laws of economics at work.
So that's why regulation fails, essentially, of spam.
Yes, it's because you're trying to repeal the laws of economics. No one can do that.
We haven't talked yet about this, but can you talk a little bit about the ramifications of now allowing individuals and corporations to patent particular gene sequences, which may, in fact, be found within nature? Someone identifies it and writes it down and can get a patent for that sequence.
Well, the ramifications are that if you use that particular knowledge, you have to pay them. Now, as a scientist, I'm interested in lots of things, including how life works. I would just love to know how living things figure out to do what they do. But I've understood now that's kind of a dream, and that the reality is there's just too much danger there and too much money to be made. And so I don't think those problems are going to be solved anytime soon, basically because there are roadblocks in the way. The knowledge of how life works is one of those things that's very valuable and also very dangerous. And so I think it's on its way to becoming permanently sequestered, and so that the general public will probably never know those things. Now, that's one of the consequences. Obviously, another consequence is the companies that are sequestering the sequences might make some money. So that's another consequence. So maybe you buy their stock, although this week may not be a good week to do that. You buy their stock, and then they sell some of those gene sequences to research organizations, and you make a little bit of profits. Those are the two consequences.
We have an email from Stephen in Dallas who says, here's a theoretical question. Fast forward 50 or 100 years and assume that we have the technology to upload knowledge and information directly into people's brains. How do you think we will choose who gets to receive that sort of rapid learning and knowledge?
Well, gosh, I'll tell you, I would really hate that myself. But the answer in I think, my experience as a citizen and a parent is that all questions of that kind are handled economically. In other words, the knowledge becomes a product, and you buy it or not. So the person is going to give you that, and then you buy it. And that's the answer. And then some things you can't sequester, and so you get those for free. Actually, I don't see the difference between putting knowledge directly in your brain and listening to a piece of music. You're using the technology of your ear, so it's a little slower, but the basic idea is the same. So we're doing that now, and you handle it economically. And a corollary of that is that all the free stuff will become spam. So if we have this future in which there's a lot of free knowledge out there that you can pipeline into your head, I don't think I want that, because there'll be this giant pipeline, this coaxial cable of knowledge that's going to fill my brain up with spam. No, thank you.
Robert B. Laughlin is my guest. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the information age and whether or not it is, in fact, a fallacy with Robert B. Laughlin. He's a 1998 Nobel laureate in physics and a professor at Stanford University. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Lucas in Dallas writes, it seems like the people who would be able to create and maintain these information sequestration systems would probably be the very people who would most want information to be free and who would be unwilling to uphold the system. So how would you imagine the future in light of that assumption?
I have what I think is an insightful answer to this question. The premise of the question is false. The premise of the question is that technical people are in control, and that's not the world I live in. Of course, I live in Silicon Valley here, which is a notorious cradle of innovation. But the reality is that technical people work for capital, not the other way around. And so the people are doing the sequestering work for the people who want it sequestered. And that's the way it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. Do you find that most people are sort of apathetic about this?
No. You find that it was an interesting experiment, actually. I came upon this subject by diffusing toward it. No, it's very sensitive to most people because... Well, the bettering yourself by knowledge is a very ancient idea that actually has its roots in religious traditions. And so people have very strong feelings about it for reasons they don't understand. Of course, you have to articulate the idea correctly. It's very easy to articulate it in some complex way, and then the person will just dismiss it and say, oh, that's technical. You know, I don't need to know that. That's not important. The key piece of the reasoning is to understand that the way you hide information is by making it a needle in a haystack. The way you hide important things is by making them look unimportant. Where I learned this, by the way, was classic, is when I was in the Army. I worked in an office that was a communications office, and of course what we did is we kept the communications pipeline filled with spam. We filled it very deliberately with spam, and the reason for that is that in case of war, you don't want the enemy seeing an increase of traffic in the line. So you keep the lines filled with standard operating procedures for the canteen and, you know, and the spare parts for the motor pool and stuff like that, knowing full well that if things get serious, the messages are going to change. You're going to talk about breaking out the nuclear warheads.
So you have to have some way, though, to allow the people on the other end to know what to decode and what to sort of ignore.
Sure. Right. And everybody's busy, you know, making a living, so they don't have time to worry about this in their daily lives. But most of us have kids, and then you're dealing with this, you know, what school should I go to? What should you study? How should you invest your time? And so these questions always pop up when your kids are entering young adulthood, which fortunately kids continue to do forever and ever. So it's something at least people with families think about obsessively. It's a soccer mom thing.
How do you prepare your students at Stanford to deal with the reality as it exists right now and probably will into the future?
Well, this may shock you, but the thing we're talking about right now is too hard for most 20-year-old people to fully process. It's something I discovered, incidentally, on the road talking about it. And this turns out to be true in every country, by the way, not just the U.S. It's when you're in your early 20s, you're very artistic, and your way you're thinking is that I can do anything. You know, I just put my mind to it, and I can accomplish anything. I can do anything. I can go anywhere. And that's where you're coming from when you're in your early 20s. Now, people who are in their 30s or later have a little life experience under their belt, and then they're ready to talk about it because they've had the experiences necessary to make it make sense. You know, they've understood their own limitations, how life is finite, your energies are finite, you go to work, you come back from work, you're exhausted, you can't stay up and study Russian that night, you know, because you just don't have any energy left. So the students, I don't usually try to work on them. But if we have an auditorium filled with the students and their parents, then it works because I get all these great questions from the parents.
That raises an interesting point about the educational system as it exists in most of the world today. It does seem that when you're young, no matter how bright you are, no matter how much you've studied, there's context that you can't possibly get in the amount of time that we expect someone to grab it, you know, within a regular, you know, master's degree level education, if you have it sort of going straight through.
Well, that's true, although you must have met people in your own experience who are just mature beyond their years, and we all wind up working for such people when we advance in age. So there are some individuals who just get it right away. But most people really don't engage. They don't click into the economy until their late 20s. And why is that? I don't know. You know, some developmental thing. Ask my wife. She's the expert in kids and development and stuff like that. All I can tell you is that the people that I've worked with, not just at Stanford, but everywhere, you know, Harvard, around the world, this is a very general thing, that even very, very smart people have holes in what they can see just because of the way they're built physically. And you're just built to be an optimist when you're 20, and you just have a real hard time grasping these limitations until you're a little older.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Robert B. Laughlin. The new book is The Crime of Reason. Let's go next to Leo in Fort Worth. Hi, Leo.
Hello, Chris. How you doing?
Great, thank you.
What an incredible show. I'm really enjoying it, and I'm definitely going to buy the book. And I wanted to ask whether, in his realm of experience, Professor Laughlin believes that, given how much we don't know about the true nature of the universe, how much we're still discovering, whether it might, you know, what's his determination on the probability that sequestering information on such things such as, you know, energy and its true nature and you know, whatever we can discover about it, whether it's actually possible to have it sequestered. Like, what if it's, you know, this is something that it's probably hard for me to get my mind wrapped around, but what if the nature of the universe or the design, if there is a design, is that it's not sequesterable? And then my other question was directed towards, you know, information. If it's as much of a whiskey bottle situation as he's talking about, or as you were talking about, Professor, is it a situation where we should just be extremely grateful that we're living in an age where we can currently learn as much as we can possibly sponge up to ourselves, and we should just learn everything that we can now?
What great questions, Leo. Thanks. Let's see. But there's several of them in quick succession, so I hope I don't let any drop off the table. Now, the first thing you ask is an interesting thing about energy. And, of course, I'm an energy guy because I'm a physicist. So, and I'm pretty up on what's known there. And so the one answer there is that experimental science is you measure what you can measure. So there's stuff about black holes and very tiny length scales in the vacuum of space that are beyond your ability to measure right now, and so you just can't know that right now. You have to wait till the machines are better. Now, the other side of that argument is energy for the people, as say power, electric power, gas, so forth. Now, there, I'm reasonably confident that there is no knowledge dearth, that the issues in energy delivery and use are all economic without exception. That is to say, the means are out there to get off oil if you wish, but it costs too much. And so the if we're going to have a discussion about that side of energy, then we have to put science aside and start talking about economics. Now, you ask if there are certain things that can't be sequestered because they're just too elegant. Yes, there are some things that can't be sequestered because they're too elegant. But it turns out you don't make money with those. Okay? You make money with the little details. Like, for example, let me give you a nice concrete example. So you know about atoms. You know about steel, metals. You know, you use metals for everything. What you don't know is that there's a whole book of secret recipes for making alloys, little bits of impurities and how you process and so forth, and making corrosion resistance, and they're all metallurgist bag of tricks. And those are the things that you need for making good steel. And so you can know everything about atoms and quantum mechanics and the basic physics of everything, and you still won't be able to make good piece of steel because you don't know these secret cooking recipes. For that matter, you can't even make good cake for the same reason. You know, you don't need to know the tricks. And so it's the little details that are the sequestered knowledge. And by the way, the knowledge on which real economic activity is always built. Now, your third question was about information and whether you should despair over it. Well, no, you know, you shouldn't despair over anything. But what you should understand is that we're at a nexus right now in history where a problem that's been there since the 18th century has now gone from a mere detail to essential to life. And that's the whiskey aspect. You see, when the economy works on exchanging physical assets, then we're less concerned about who owns what knowledge. But now, when you're offshoring and outsourcing all of physical manufacture, so physical things now are commodities, then who owns what knowledge suddenly becomes rather important. It's the core of the economy, the core, not just a mere detail anymore, but the entire essence of the economy. Then it's serious because it's how you make your living. And it bears directly on the question of how all of us are going to make our living in the future. Now, I imagined knowledge is a golden thing that I would go and I would become Socrates and teach all my students all these wonderful things, and they would be happy, and then we'd drink a little wine and be even happier and so forth. But the technical economy I actually live in isn't like that. It's filled with secrecy, filled with the darkest secrets. You don't tell people. The only things you tell people are the things that are not important. Well, that, I fear, is what the knowledge economy is. The knowledge economy is a time when all of us are scrambling to prevent each other from knowing things. And I think that is going to escalate over time, and that those people who don't abide by that rule and just give away their knowledge are doomed to be poor. And yes, I do believe that's a whiskey.
Here's the whiskey issue to probably end the show on. And I don't know.
By the way, I don't drink too much. I just metaphorical.
I get it. I'm not sure, Robert, whether this is a question of physics or of faith or of personal philosophy. But absent the workings of the knowledge economy as it exists now, and assuming that human beings could live for enough generations and eons to get all this work done, do you think that we actually possess the capacity to fully comprehend the universe?
Well, I can just tell you what I know. Richard Feynman once said that you've learned more when the number of equations goes down. Okay, that's what learning is the details go away and you see the rules. Now, what I think I've learned in my professional lifetime is that there are lots of things in nature that you can master, and there's more to come. For sure, there's more to come. But what I hadn't reckoned on is that my fellow human beings working hard to prevent me from knowing them. Okay. Now, moreover, that I have to play the poker game too. In other words, in order to really master these wonderful things in the universe, I can't do it myself. I need help. And what I think I've discovered is that help will never come. And the reason is because it's economically impossible.
Robert B. Laughlin shared the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1998 for his work on the fraction quantum Hall effect. He's professor of physics at Stanford University. His new book is called The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Robert, a great deal to think about. Thank you so much for spending the hour with
Thanks
us.
Thanks a million. Well, enjoy your afternoon there in Texas.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.